a conclusion that you came to as a child based on your experience that you can either be yourself or you can be loved, but you can't be both.
So, you know, we tend to kind of naturally fear and resist those kinds of moments, but there is a breaking open that happens as well.
Welcome back.
Welcome back, everybody.
We are so excited to share this episode with you. A while back, we discussed introversion and extroversion and the difference between the two. And the reason that topic was so interesting to myself and to you, Rivka, is we just read this book called Quiet, which was a smash hit international bestseller by Susan Cain.
And most recently, she wrote a New York Times bestseller, Bittersweet. And you'll hear within the episode, I really found that it relates a lot to Hasidus and the paradox of living with difficulty and also joy, with pain and joy, and how we can apply that into our lives and really internalize it.
And in case you have not heard of Susan Cain, give you a little brief introduction. Her book, Quiet, is currently in its 7th year on the New York Times bestseller list. It was named the number one best book of the year by Fast Company magazine, which also named Cain one of its most creative people in business. Her record-smashing TED Talk has been viewed over 30 million times and was named by Bill Gates one of his favorite talks of all time.
Ida, have you watched the TED Talk?
I have, and I will include a link to the talk in the podcast notes. I think it's absolutely worth watching.
I haven't seen it, so I'm with you all in watching the TED Talk. She received Harvard Law School's Celebration Award of Thought Leadership. She was named one of the world's top 50 leadership and management experts by Inc. magazine and was named 6th top influencer in the world by LinkedIn. Susan has partnered with Malcolm Gladwell, Adam Grant, and Dan Pink to launch the next big Ideal Book Club, and they donate all their proceeds to children's literacy programs.
And if that's not impressive enough, she is also an honors graduate of Princeton and Harvard Law School, and she's spoken at places like Microsoft, Google, Harvard, Yale, West Point, the U.S. Naval Academy, and I could go on, but the list is just simply too long. One of the unique things about our podcast is that we love to bring you people from all walks of life, including internationally acclaimed best-selling authors and leaders, and also our everyday heroes. Who we believe all have so much to teach us about life and giving us more perspective. Susan currently lives in Hudson River Valley with her husband and 2 sons, and super excited to bring you this.
Yeah, one thing that stands out to me that I'm sure you'll pick up on in the episode is that we're all really coming from the same place. Her conclusions in her book, Bittersweet, really are very similar to the concepts that we've grown up with. And they might be coming from different angles, but they're all coming from the same source, from our souls.
Yeah, I agree. And it was cool to talk about our shared faith. You know, she's Jewish, and what role it played in her life and in her work. And we hope that you gain insight and gather some pearls of wisdom from this conversation.
Joy. Hi, I'm Rivka.
And I'm Ida. Welcome to the From the Inside Out podcast.
We're mompreneurs and friends who love connecting through meaningful conversations.
It all started in an Uber, where we were both so inspired by each other's life experiences. And it was then and there that we decided to create this platform, because we believe in the power of growth, self-awareness, and connection.
Our goal is to bring you insights, research-backed tools, tips and shortcuts, and interviews with some of our world's greatest thinkers, leaders, and everyday heroes.
We invite you to join us as we create positive change in mind, body, and soul.
From the inside out.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to have you on our show.
Oh, thank you so much.
We just interviewed Joseph Telushkin. Have you heard of him?
Of course.
Yes. Yeah. He actually told me that you share the same, is it producer?
Agent. Or yeah, our literary agent. Yeah.
Yes. And he's told us that he knew your grandfather, who you wrote about in the book, that he was a really great rabbi.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know he knew my or maybe I did know and I'm spacing that, but wow. Did he know him well?
He told us that he remembered him, and he was a very impressive, really a great rabbi.
Oh my gosh. I didn't actually realize that part of our connection.
Also, I happen to be a big fan of Leonard Cohen, and you dedicated your book Bittersweet to him, which drew much of his lyrics, which are Kabbalistic concepts.
Yes.
And your favorite quote happens to be my favorite quote. Ida can attest to it. There's a crack in everything. That's where the light gets in.
I believe you. I know, it's the best.
I wanted you to share with our listeners what meaning it carries for you.
I think in a way, it's the whole reason I wrote the book and the reason that I've loved Leonard Cohen my whole life is wrapped up in that one verse. I guess that's why I made it the epigraph, because I think that verse is getting at the fact that everything is broken and everything is beautiful simultaneously. And that I feel like we live in a culture that tells us not to acknowledge everything around us that's broken. Like if you were to talk about it, that would be seen as being too gloomy, too morbid, too Eeyore-like, like a certain uncoolness in doing that. You're supposed to be, you know, positive, upbeat, cheerful all the time. Without realizing that there's a way of telling the truth and acknowledging everything that's broken at the same time that within all the breakage is where you find so much beauty. That quote is giving a permission to acknowledge the broken and also to be looking for beauty and seeing it and finding it everywhere you go.
Yeah.
That's what I love in his music.
Yeah. Like stop hiding from the pain, work directly into it.
Yeah, exactly. I think to pretend that it's not there is actually to create more pain. It's to create a kind of like, you know, constant emotional labor of like, you know, see no evil, hear no evil, like that kind of thing. Like, well, it's all there, but I'm going to pretend it's not. Instead of just saying, yes, this is what life is and we're in it together. And life is also joy and beauty and love. And it's all one great big mishmash.
It's a hopeful verse as well, because the bottom line is there is a crack in everything, but just to know that that's where the light comes from.
Exactly.
Is hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're conditioned to believe that we can't experience conflicting emotions and we can't feel happy and sad simultaneously. And there's something that you talked about in your book that I think was powerful about, you know, a similar duality, a conclusion that you came to as a child based on your experience that you can either be yourself or you can be loved, but you can't be both. And that really struck me because I think at the core, that's what the majority of people are grappling with is, should I show up and should I be myself at the risk of rejection, or should I give in to whether it's peer pressure or societal standards or what I think somebody wants from me that doesn't quite reflect who I am. And maybe I have a higher likelihood of getting the love that I want, but at the risk of not really knowing who I am. And I speak for adults, but I also speak for kids too, especially kids actually. And I would imagine this starts in childhood, starts maybe with caregiver pressure and then peer pressure and all these external forces that make life very noisy and make it harder for us to discover who we are.
And I just wonder how this realization shaped you and what lessons did it teach you, you know, about love and authenticity and the relationship between them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing I would say is I don't believe that that's true in the strongest, healthiest relationships. I think in the strongest, healthiest relationships, you can be loved and be yourself. The problem is that we sometimes find ourselves in relationships where that's not true. And I think many people in that situation will choose love because love is what we fundamentally need above everything else. But it's the wrong choice. The right choice is to choose to be able to be yourself. And then the love comes from there. I mean, it might start with a self-love that comes from doing that. But the really great truth is that we can lose particular loves. You know, you might lose a particular love to a bereavement or to a betrayal or to finding yourself in the kind of relationship that's embedded in your question. But love has a way of returning in a different form. you know, so you can lose a particular love. Like if you find yourself in that kind of a relationship, you can say, no, I'm not going to accept that. And I am going to be myself. And maybe you lose that particular love, but love itself is stronger than that. So you'll find it embodied in other relationships and in your own self. That's the great truth. And it's not easy. It's not easy, especially if the relationship you're talking about is a very central one in your life. It's not easy to make that choice, but I do believe it's the right one.
I would say this idea is a life-changing one. And knowing that you can be yourself and experience true and lasting connection, that's very liberating. You know, not to say that it's a guarantee, right? Sometimes you might be yourself and be rejected, but it's a risk. It's a risk you take. And I think when you weigh the risk against the benefits, wouldn't you prefer to be yourself, even if it meant risking rejection, rather than always having to adjust to others' expectations of you and never knowing who you are? And also, can we even truly love someone else in the way they need us to love them if we're constantly changing who we are in order to be loved? You know, I feel like that carries an even greater risk of not knowing who we are and moving through the world with essentially an identity crisis.
I know you're Jewish and you would appreciate this. That's something else that we have in common. We're Jewish and we have souls and neshama, and we're all connected.
Absolutely.
Yes. So it says that Torah is based on ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, loving your neighbor as you love yourself. And it'd be very hard to love somebody else if you don't have that appreciation and love for yourself first.
I really do believe that. And I do believe the best gift that parents can give to their children is the deep knowledge that they can be whoever they are and be 100% fully loved. You know, and that they can misstep and they can make mistakes, they could do stupid things or, you know, bad things, and they're still going to be loved throughout all of it. That's the greatest gift of all.
Yeah. Unconditional love and unconditional pride.
So your book is called Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole. And, you know, you talk about how sorrow, if embraced, you know, the how sorrow is kind of like in those shards, right? It's part of the human experience and we can embrace it and know that that's part of what makes life beautiful. But what about longing? You know, what would be your definition of longing? Because I feel like, you know, many of us might have different ways of understanding it, and it could be seen, I guess, as a good thing or not a good thing. But can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, what longing is and what it means when it comes to the human experience?
Yeah. I mean, so there's a kind of more superficial version of longing, you could say, you know, like you're longing for a certain car or a certain house or whatever. And I guess that is longing, but it's not really what I happen to be talking about in this book. I'm talking more about a kind of spiritual longing for, you know, that which is most good, beautiful, true, divine, you could say. I believe it's the core of human emotional DNA, whether we consider ourselves secular, atheists, believers, anything in between, it makes no difference. That longing has been part of humanity from the dawn of recorded time. And, you know, and you see it in all different cultures and all different manifestations. And I mean, the religious expressions of it are really interesting, you know, like the longing for the Garden of Eden, right? And the longing for Zion and the longing for Mecca, or the Sufis talk about the longing for the connection with the beloved of the soul, which is their expression for the divine. That, I think that's the best in humanity, that longing. And then, and you see it manifested in these, in secular expressions too, like in The Wizard of Oz, there's Dorothy and she's longing for somewhere over the rainbow. And in Harry Potter, right? He, like so many children's heroes, he enters the story at the exact moment that he becomes an orphan. So like at the exact moment that his parents are killed and he's now like thrust into this life of deep longing for their love and just to know them. That's when he enters the story. That's when the adventure begins. And this is true if you look at all at the structure of so many different stories. You know, like in Homer's Odyssey, you have Ulysses who the whole poem starts with him weeping on a beach out of homesickness. He's longing for home. He's longing for his island of Ithaca. And it's understood that that deep homesickness is what propels him on the whole epic journey that we call the Odyssey. But that's what our lives are. That's just a metaphor for our lives. We all enter this world with a kind of deep-seated longing for home. You could call it longing for God, whatever expression we give to it. We enter this world with that, and that's what propels us on our adventure in the first place. So in our culture, we think of longing as this, like, you know, wallowing, inactive state, and it's actually the exact opposite is true. It's longing that propels us and makes us creative in the first place.
We're Chabad girls, Ida and I. Have you heard of Chabad?
I have.
Yes. Yeah. So when I read your book, to me, it felt like I was reading Chassidus. I took it that, yes, we're born with this longing. You know, we're brought down in this world. Our soul is brought down in this world, and it yearns to connect to God and to bring God's light into the world. Because I think you even mentioned in the book the breaking of the vessels.
Yes,
breaking.
I love that.
Yes, and that actually is spoken about in Tanya in Chassidus. It's called Orein Sof. Like there was this big light, and then the world couldn't handle it. The vessels couldn't handle it to put the light in there, and they broke, and they've been shattered into the world. And we're here to pick up the fragments and to reveal God's light.
I love that. What do you call it? Parable? Is that the right word for it? I always refer to it as a parable. I'm not sure.
It's actually not a parable. It's the way the world was before it was created.
I love that so much. I find it like incredibly, first of all, comforting, but then second of all, inspiring. You know, and it's comforting because it's like admit what we were talking about at the beginning. It's admitting the fact that we live in the world after the breakage. Just to be able to say that out loud, I find comforting. But then the inspiration comes from the fact of, well, but then there's all the shards of light all around us. And and the mission is to pick them up, and that you're going to see different ones from the ones that I see. You're going to pick up different ones from the ones I pick up, but we're all doing our part. I love that as just a way to live.
Yeah. And I really felt that in your book. So I wanted to say thank you for that. And that's how I saw the longing. The longing is to pick up those pieces and reveal the light into this world in the way that we, each of us individually can, in our unique way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you feel like it's something we all have inherently, or is it more specific to certain people? I feel like as a Jewish woman, it's sort of like in a way embedded in my DNA, you know, that longing for, you know, what we call Geula or messianic times. Like, do you find that it exists more amongst certain people than it does among others?
It's been really interesting. I find that some people seem to be born with it. And in fact, you know how in the book, I have the bittersweet quiz that you can take to find out like how prone you are to these kinds of states.
Yeah.
And we found that for people who score high on the quiz, they also tend to score high on the quiz that measures whether you have a highly sensitive temperament or not. And that highly sensitive people are about 15 to 20% of the population. So I'm guessing.
Only 15 to 20%? I would have thought it's more.
No, that's what it is. It's 15 to 20%. And these are people who are like just super reactive to everything about life. You know, they feel the pains more intensely. They appreciate the beauties with a little more intensity, all of it.
Ida and I are one of those. I guess that's why we can really connect it to your book.
Oh, totally. No, I knew you were one of those right away. So I think that's some of the people, but then I think other people come to it through life experience. Some of it you're referring to inherited grief, you know, like a kind of the grief of the generations who came before you, I think, predisposes people to this kind of longing. And then for some people, it's the griefs that they, or you could say the collection of griefs and triumphs that they accumulate throughout their lifetime predisposes them to it. Mm-hmm. So it comes at all different points. One friend of mine, she's a
a very well-known psychologist. And if you met her, she's really funny and brisk and upbeat and capable and hilarious. And so she took my bittersweet quiz and scored a zero. It's like she did not relate to one single item on
it. Wow.
So that's just to say people really do come in so many different varieties and with so many different kinds of powers.
Yeah. But it's interesting how you say like your friend could be at a zero and there could be other people like that. And like you say, then life experience changed them. Life experiences change them.
Absolutely.
And just make them, I guess their sorrows make them create a longing and a sensitivity to others and things that are going on in the world. It, not to say that they're not sensitive. They're just, it creates a new deep kind of sensitivity in general.
I think it's a specific type of frequency and sensitivity.
Right.
Yeah. And David Yaden, who co-created the quiz with me, he's a researcher at Johns Hopkins and he does research on psychedelics and other things. And he's really interested in spirituality. And he did one study where he kind of tracked when do people have their greatest, deepest experiences of transcendence and spirituality. And he found that they tend to occur at moments of transition, including difficult life transitions. So, you know, moments of divorce or moments before death, places like that are when people reliably track having these moments. So, you know, we tend to kind of naturally fear and resist those kinds of moments, but there is a breaking open that happens as well.
Yeah. That can also be a moment where you feel so much pain and that when you feel that pain, you connect to God. And that is when that moment comes of like that connection is a very spiritual, powerful moment. And often it comes through pain.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you find that more sensitive people are more, or maybe have an easier time dealing with life's transitions because we kind of have that as our default state? Like someone who scored a zero would probably...
It's easier, they're stronger, they're able to deal. I don't know, but I think sensitive people have it harder. I mean, that's what I think, but I don't know. What do you think, Susan?
Well, I think it goes in both directions. I mean, yes, there's something sensitivity by definition. You're going to feel everything that much more keenly, but you're also going to be much less surprised and blindsided when troubles come, because I think there's more of an understanding of what life is. I mean, like the way I see it, the joys and the beauties and then the pains and the troubles, they're all part of the same path. They're all part of the same road. But the way our culture teaches it, it's like when things are going well, that's the main road. And then when the troubles come, that's like a detour from the main road. And so when that happens, if you see it that way, not only are you feeling the pain of the thing that just happened to you, but you also have the extra pain of like resisting it and saying like, this wasn't supposed to happen. Like it wasn't supposed to be this way. Whereas I think a more sensitive person knows that it's all part of the road. So there's less of that resistance.
Right. I hear you. Can I ask you though about longing in reference to long-term relationships? You know, yes. you had mentioned this book, The Bridges of Madison County, which Ian and I both ran to watch and bawled our eyes out when we watched it. So how does one confront longing that shows up in long-term relationships? Do you believe people have this, well, you do mention it there, but an unrealistic expectation of love and romance? Then we find ourselves longing for this romance and maybe this unrealistic expectation. Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Yeah. There is in our culture, it goes all the way back to the time of Plato, like the idea of that there is a soulmate out there that, you know, that humans were originally like, one complete unit divided into two, and then each unit divided into two. And then the quest of your life is to find that missing half and then finally be whole. And I think that we consciously or unconsciously go into our marriages and our long-term relationships, expecting it to be that way and believing we've now found the complete whole and the complete unit. By whole, I mean W-H-O-L-E, not H-O-L-E.
Right. Yes.
So, and so then what happens is, you know, you get into the relationship and like, oh, actually, you know, your partner has all kinds of flaws. And in fact, so do you, and your flaws might be driving your partner a bit crazy, and their flaws are doing that for you. And again, it's that thing of the resistance. It's like the flaws themselves, or the imperfections themselves, might be enough of a job of a lifetime to work through and incorporate into your love. But then on top of that, there's the resistance of like, oh, it wasn't supposed to be this way. You know, it was supposed to be that we were one effortless, complete unit. And that can make things very difficult for people. And I do think there's probably relationships, you know, just the way there are some people who win the lottery. I think there are some people who like are really lucky to have relationships with almost none of that kind of friction. But that's not true for the vast majority of people. For most relationships, there's intense love, and then there are incompatibilities to work through. And I think what's really happening is the, like on a deep level, I think that the desire for a love relationship that would be that effortless whole, W-H-O-L-E, is really a metaphor for the desire, like for spiritual longing itself, you know, the desire for perfect love, the desire for union with the divine, and our relationships are a metaphor for that.
That's really beautiful. I think in a relationship specifically, sometimes the resistance and the misrepresentation of longing, or like the misunderstanding of what longing really is, can cause even more separation and friction that is maybe unnecessary. There's this word in Hebrew, bitachon, which is like a complete trust that everything is meant to be as it is, and to be fully accepting of what is. And with the good and the bad, but it's not, with having in mind that the bad is in fact not different from the good, because it's all part of our story. It's par and parcel.
You know, it's complicated because I think there are some bads, I'll put it in quotes, that we shouldn't live with and that we shouldn't consent to live with. But then there's kind of the everyday bads and goods that really just are what they are.
There are some birds we'll never understand. Like, I mean, I just see it that I'm a human being, and God has his ways, and he knows, we believe that it's good because God created it, but we want revealed good. That's the point, is that there's the bad, but is it really bad? It's the way we're seeing it, but is it really that way? I believe that it's ultimately good because God has created it, and God is all good, but it can be hard. It's hard to actually live with, and it feels bad and it feels difficult, but it's a comforting thought to know that this is what was meant to be. Like, this is what God has given us to deal with.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, for me, there are certain bads that are beyond my ability to see in the light of acceptance. I don't really accept them. To me, it's more a question of like acknowledging a world in which those exist alongside beauty, and like, and how do you make sense of that juxtaposition?
How do you make sense of it? That I totally hear you. The way I make sense of it is that I'm never going to understand everything. Do you know what I mean? I'm not going to understand when something bad happens. I can't explain it because I'm a human being. But I take comfort in the fact that God knows what he's doing.
Well, the reason I think I love so much the idea of the breakage of the divine vessel, and now the shards all around us, is it's a, I don't know, it's a way of looking at it all without needing to make sense of it, but to acknowledge, but you can acknowledge it.
Yeah.
It gives you the space to acknowledge the horrors of the world alongside the beauties of the world without needing to make sense of them.
I think the distinction here is that when it comes to something like bitachon, which is, you know, full trust or surrender or submission to what is or what has happened, is that, you know, the bad that is unchanging or out of our control, like the things that maybe the things that have happened in the past or things happening today that we don't have the capacity to change. Those things, you know, on some level, we've accepted that we don't have control over the outcome of them. But then the things that I think maybe that you were, that the feelings you were referring to earlier about, you know, the certain injustices or bads in the world that you haven't accepted or that you, you know, you can't really understand or wrap your head around. Those are the things that I think exist so that we can do our part and, you know, pick up the broken pieces and, you know, pick up those shards of glass and do our part like Tikkun Olam and make a difference.
There's this quote by Steve Jobs that you can't connect the dots moving, looking forward, but you can connect them, you know, looking back. So maybe
this that
is
quote.
A way. Yeah, me too. It's just like, for me, a way to understand that everything that's happened until now, you know, happened for a reason.
And if you look to history or even today, like people who are leaders and people making a difference in the world are mostly, if not all, people who have gone through struggles and pain and are, you know, almost leveraging that pain, like using it to be able to make a difference and help other people. So I feel like in that regard, it does, not that it makes sense. You can never understand it, but we see, you know, wounded healers all around us. And
the whole notion of a wounded healer is that through my pain, I've been able to help someone else work through theirs. And without my pain, I would not have been able to do that. What's your understanding of the wounded healer and the role that the pain plays in helping us help others?
I think it actually starts with helping ourselves. I think it's the best way that we have of helping ourselves. I mean, like in the book, I say, whatever pain you can't get rid of, make it your creative offering. And I use the word creative, broad strokes there. I don't mean paint a painting necessarily. Right. I think reliably the best way to heal ourselves is to heal someone else who's suffering, or try to heal someone else who's suffering a very similar type of pain. And that's why we have so many stories in our mythologies of wounded healers across time, because that is what people instinctively do. And I don't even think we realize we're doing it. You know, so like after 9/11, suddenly lots of people were signing up to become firefighters. And with the pandemic, suddenly lots of people signing up for nursing school and medical school, like the application rates go way up. And I don't know, like how many people are consciously even making the connection of like a building just went down, so now I will become a firefighter. Some of them probably is conscious, but either way, it's a very deep impulse that we have.
From having read your books and seeing a lot of your work, which has been tremendously impactful in my life, I think, you know, before you wrote your book, Quiet, on you know, being an introvert, I'm an introvert, and I kind of saw being an introvert as a negative thing, and then you changed my perception of introversion. And I think you did the same with sadness and longing, and helped us understand that it's not necessarily what we think it might be, which is negative, you know. And would you say that that's sort of your story, being a wounded healer, so to speak, helping others through your own journey?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me specifically, yeah, those are the things that I was called to write about and to work on. And, you know, my inbox is full of letters of people like telling me their stories in those particular areas. And it's not just that those are the ones that I know best. It's that those are the ones I have felt myself. And so, like, I feel this deep, deep, you know, desire and compulsion to want to like heal psychic pain and unleash potential of people who have felt similar things to those that I have felt. But as I say, like, I don't think we think of it consciously. It's not like I wake up and say, I will now, you know, I've been introverted and thought about this, so now I will try to help other introverts. It's not conscious like that. It's more that, I don't know. I think it's more just actions you take based on your life experiences.
Would you say that what you're sharing now is a peak experience of yours when you heal somebody else? Because you talk about peak experiences in your book, and I wanted you to share with us what you call a peak experience and an example of a peak experience for you. Maybe it's what you've just shared.
Oh, those certainly are some of my peak experiences. I mean, it is like the best feeling in the world that you can imagine, like to get a letter from someone, let's say, who tells me, you know, that their life has been changed or transformed in some way because of something I wrote or said or whatever. Like there's nothing better. It's incredible. But I don't know. I think of peak experiences as anything that is so elevating that it carries you outside of yourself and where you feel connected to the all or just to other people or to whatever it is. And like this whole book started with my crazy love of sad music and
so relate to that. I also love sad music.
so then you know what I mean. Like what I was trying to understand about it was, why did this music make me feel not sad at all, but rather connected to all of humanity? Like there's just this deep, I would feel this deep love for the musician, for being able to express what humans have always felt and to express it with so much beauty.
Oh my God, you're just reminding me because we heard you on the Tim Ferriss podcast. You had also shared that you love Idan Raquel. And I've actually been to a concert of his. It was like the most epic experience.
Yes.
So I know that you love Idan Raquel as well.
I love Idan Raquel. He's an amazing singer. He's an amazing soul.
Composer. Yeah.
He's also quite introverted. And I'm sure you noticed at his concert, like he's like this amazing figure because he brings together all these musicians into these great collaborations, like people from all over the world. And then he is always stationed at the very side of the stage, you know.
I know that's how it usually is, but it happened to be a very unique situation. It was a concert in New York. It was in a bar and there were just 100 people there and he sang all the songs. So it was a very unique situation.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Okay.
And he told us that he doesn't usually do that and he usually brings other people, but this was, but you could see that he was an introvert. He was very humble about it all. And
yes,
it wasn't like, you could see it wasn't what he naturally wants to do. He naturally just wants to give it over to somebody else.
Very, very much so. Yeah. He's very humble. You could see it even in his music video collaborations. He has an amazing one with Vieux Farka Touré. I don't know if you've followed those. They're so beautiful. And in those videos too, like the spotlight is all on his collaborator and not on him at all.
I'll have to look up. I'm very bad with names, but I'll look that one up. Okay, if you sang the song, I'd know it.
There's an amazing one called Mon Amour, but they did two full albums together.
Yeah. You played a song on the Tim Ferriss show with one of your songs that I loved.
I played Hinach Yafa, right?
Yeah. Hinach Yafa.
God, I love that one.
Why yeah, it's beautiful. But what were you saying? That the sad music...
Peak experiences. So sad music is reliably a peak experience because it makes you feel so connected to humanity and to the musician. And I don't know if... I know you said you're a lover of sad music. I don't know if you get the following sensation, but when it's really good, I have this feeling after I listen to it of like, you know what? It's okay that we're all mortal. Like it doesn't bother me for 3 minutes after I listen to that music. I'm like, yes, we're mortal and that's the way it should be. You know, there's no longer any resistance to it. I don't know what that is, but it's like the same thing as, I don't know if you know that song Diamonds and Rust by Joan Baez. It's basically this song that's all about her love affair with Bob Dylan. And she's recalling it long after their breakup. And there's one line in the song where she says, she's recalling this peak moment that they had where they're walking through Washington Square Park and it's a wintry day and their breath hangs like clouds in the air. And then she says, speaking strictly for myself, we both could have died then and there. And I think we all know that feeling of like the moment is so transcendent, so beautiful, such a love that like that's all you need. And now you can be done.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I think that sometimes sad music can make you like so emotional and you think it's sad, but then if you really recognize it, well, especially with Jewish music, I find that it can be so emotional that you kind of feel like you're in touch with your identity, like it's getting you to a place of found. And sometimes you think, oh, the sad music is making me sad, but really it's just so emotional because you're getting in touch with your essence.
Yes, I completely
experience that.
Yeah. A lot of, like,
I always feel that at the minor key, by the way. Wait, what did you say, Ida?
No, I just said that a lot of Jewish music is in the minor key.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Minor key. Yeah.
Yeah. But sometimes, like we were sharing about relationships, sometimes you can hear a love song and you get emotional about that longing. Like someone can get emotional about that longing that they may not necessarily have. And it can really just be sad because you feel like, hey, I don't have whatever this song is sharing, but I long for that.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, there is actual sadness in sad music. But I think, I don't know, even there, I feel like you feel the promise of it. It's like, right. I don't have it now, but I might have it in the future. You know, and it's the state of humans to get closer to the thing that we're longing for.
Yeah. And like you say, through the pain, through that, you know, the bittersweet, through the bitterness, through the tears or through the longing comes the sweetness.
Absolutely. In Bittersweet, I actually tell the Hasidic parable. I can't remember how I came across it, but the parable of a rabbi who notices that there's a man in his congregation who is not really paying very much attention to his talk of the divine. He doesn't seem to buy it. And then the rabbi hums for him a melody of yearning, and the man listens and he says, now I understand what you were trying to tell us all this time, because I hear this melody and I feel an intense longing to be united with the Lord. And I love that parable so much. I feel like I'm kind of like that old man a little bit. Like there's something about that music, with that saying, like the music unlocks us, you know, the sorrow unlocks us, the minor key unlocks us.
Yeah, I like that way of putting it. It unlocks us.
Yeah, like when I'm listening to a song and I'm so connected to it and I'm with someone, or like, and I say, like, isn't this song incredible? And they kind of shrug, maybe they shrug their shoulders, like they don't have that same connection as I do. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's some people just feel that much more strongly through that connection through music specifically, more than anything.
Ida's a composer.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that. What kind of music do you compose?
Actually, I play by ear. I don't read musical notes. So it's all kind of, it's an intuitive, natural process. And it's a lot, very much in the minor key. It's not formal music. I'm not formally trained, but I really do it as a hobby.
And I used to be a singer.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Wow. And you are a singer.
I guess once a singer, always a singer. But
can I just ask you, how do you know each other?
We decided to go to we knew each other from
Dada. My sister-in-law, my husband's sister, married Rivka's brother.
Your husband's sister married Rivka's brother. Okay.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So we met each other.
So you're really family.
Yeah. Well, we connected at the wedding, but then like years went by and then there was an entrepreneur summit in New York. And scrolling through my feed and I had wanted to learn, it was about like growing your business. And I had wanted to go to this summit and I had seen Ida had just launched her business. And so I just decided to text her because I really liked her to see if she wanted to go there with me. And she said, you know what, I'm going to hop on a plane. She lives in Miami and yeah, I'm going to come with you. And she met me, we met in an Uber and we started talking to each other about each other's struggles and how we've grown. We never really connected in that way. And then she made a joke and said, you know, we should start a podcast. And then 3 days later, I texted her, you know, that joke he made, should we start a podcast? And she's like, yes. And
gosh,
we started
goosebumps.
One.
That's incredible. How long
it
have
just
you
happened
been
to be during
podcast?
COVID, right when COVID started, we had already recorded our first episode and we had to re-record it because of everything that was going on. We wanted to talk about like the pandemic. And so we put it out and it's just grown exponentially. So we've been very, very blessed.
I'm an extrovert. Ida's an introvert. So we're
very complimentary.
Yeah. We balance each other out.
Yeah.
We appreciate each other. And then, but I also think of myself as an introvert sometimes, but generally, yeah. But what I wanted to say was, is that I'm a health coach and Ida is a mental health counselor. So we thought we'd do mind and body, and then we bring the soul into it. So sometimes we do conversations with each other and then we also bring on guests. And we're very honored to have you.
That is so great. Well, I'm honored to be here. I love it.
I'm just wondering, you spent many years doing research and doing this work. I think you mentioned it took 7 years. Was it 7 years to write the book Bittersweet?
Yeah, it was definitely 7 years for quiet. I'm not sure. Bittersweet was probably like 6, 7. I don't know. It was a long time. I take a long time with my books.
Right.
Which, yeah, you had shared that on the Tim Ferriss. We heard that.
Yeah. So with my first one, with quiet, I was also giving birth to my two boys during those 7 years. So that obviously took some time. I think motherhood or no, I just take a really long time because I like to like really dive into a subject and just walk around the world for a few years thinking about everything through that lens before I even really do too much of the writing. So it takes a while, but I love it.
But a better way to put out a book, because then we know that you've not only done the research, but you've also spent the time kind of contemplating on what you're going to share. I'm just wondering, like, you know, from all your years of research and study on sorrow and longing, is there something that you learned, like one great lesson that you learned, or something that you discovered that maybe you was surprising for you?
Huh. I'm trying to think about it. I guess what I hadn't known going into the research was how deep and widespread these ideas are. I mean, I call it now the bittersweet tradition. And I call it that because you see it all across the world, and that people have been talking about this for centuries. And, you know, as we said, that it's like manifest in all our religions, but then in our art and literature. And I didn't really know that. I mean, the books just started out for me as a kind of intuition, you know, just like, why did I have this response to music and what did it mean? And I thought at first it was just like a musical question. And now I think music is just one portal or one manifestation of a much, much bigger phenomenon. Probably my favorite part of the book to research was, yeah, just seeing all these different manifestations across the world. You know, like in ancient Greece, they had this word potos, P-O-T-H-O-S, which means basically the longing for everything that's beautiful and unattainable. You know, and it was understood that like Odysseus was seized by Potos and Alexander the Great was seized by Potos. And, you know, and then you go to Portugal and like they're talking about saudade, which is kind of like longing for a lost love that may never have even existed in the first place. And you walk around the city of Lisbon and like the pastry shops are called saudade and the music bars are called saudade. And it's like the whole culture is steeped in it. And you see this all over the world and across the centuries. And I just find that mind-blowing to see this expression of human DNA take so many different forms. And that the spiritual longing is at the heart of everything. I think that's what really moves me.
Yeah.
You know, because it does take so many secular manifestations also, but it's all expressing the same longing that we started out talking about.
Yeah.
Wow. And we had also started out talking about how we are connected in so many different ways. And it's often said that we carry the burden of our ancestors. And I know that you are also an ancestor of Holocaust survivors. And you had mentioned epigenetics in your book and how children of Holocaust survivors experience symptoms that stem from their parents' traumatic experiences during the Holocaust. And we are also descendants of Holocaust survivors and have seen this manifest in our parents and in our grandparents' lives. Well, one of the ways that I think about breaking the cycle, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe shares this, is by focusing on the positive and knowing that we have, like, the same way we're taking on the trauma from the past, we can also take on the positive, the strength and the self-sacrifice that the past generations have had. Like, if we focus on that, we have that within us. Mm-hmm. And to know that when we go through hard times, we can bring that out. That's one way that I think is a positive way of breaking the cycle. I wanted to know, because you discussed this in your book, how you see that we can break the cycle. And what do you think of what I just shared also?
Well, I love what you just shared. And the way that I have found is to really understand on a deep level that we can send our love back to the generations who came before us and feel deeply connected to them without having to take on their pain. I think there's a way in which, if we're not thinking about it too much, you know, the pain becomes a part of our connection to those generations. But it doesn't have to be. And one thing that has really helped me in understanding this is becoming a mother and thinking about how I feel about my children's lives. My children and I are deeply connected. We always will be. But I want them to have 100% freedom to go forth and live their own lives in ways that might be informed by things I've taught them, but not that they need to carry a painful experience that I've had in my life. That shouldn't be part of them. It doesn't need to be part of them for us to love each other and feel connected. So that same freedom that I wish for my children, I think we can bestow on ourselves. And to have all the love without feeling that particular obligation.
We often feel our children are just extensions of us. And so it's up to us to mold them. And in a sense, perhaps that can be true, but they are separate entities, even though we do share the same DNA. There's a Hebrew verse about educating each child in their way. And to recognize that we need to relinquish control over our children's lives to a certain extent, obviously once they're old enough to, you know, make decisions. And it's so important to not think that we have all the answers for our kids. And I think that's part of why, you know, we might carry some of the traumas from our ancestors, is because maybe on some level they felt this responsibility that was so great that they wouldn't relinquish control.
Yeah. And I think we feel like we can't, like part of our connection to them is by honoring what they went through, but by feeling connected to their pain somehow. And I don't think we need to feel connected to their pain in order to honor what they went through and to love them.
Like, don't carry the burden of other people's pains or other people's experiences or even other people's decisions and choices.
That's a good thing to meditate on.
Yes. Yeah, a lifelong meditation.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. So we normally do a little wrap up with some questions for you. A few quick
wrap up questions.
Sure.
And thank you. We so appreciate you being here and everything that you've shared. We talked about music and different songs that you enjoy, but do you have like a favorite song that you absolutely love?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. So as you know, I'm so crazy about Leonard Cohen. So maybe my favorite Leonard Cohen song is Famous Blue Raincoat.
Oh, I love that.
I really love that song.
Yeah.
And we can put Hinach Yafa by Dan Reichel right up there too. Okay. I adore that song.
Do you know Leonard Cohen's song, If It Be Your Will?
Sure.
Yeah.
I love that too.
Yeah, that one's beautiful also. It's very meaningful to me, Leonard Cohen, because my uncle introduced it to my husband and I, and he passed away at a young age. And now my other uncle, who is alive, he often sends me Leonard Cohen songs. So I'm just,
oh, really?
I'm a big fan. Yeah.
Ah, oh, nice.
I wanted to ask you one, because it comes to mind. You
sure?
Share pictures. You share a lot of beautiful scenes on your page.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's to inspire all of us to connect to beauty and to connect to beautiful scenes, because that creates that longing for beauty. Well, you can share with us why you share those beautiful pictures and what is your favorite scene?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, it happened because I found myself, like so many other people, waking up in the morning and scrolling Twitter or whatever and just being like, you know, mired in this stew of toxicity online. And I really wanted to get out of it. So I don't even know how I had the idea, but I just randomly like tweeted and said, asking for people to share with me their favorite art accounts that they followed. And before I knew it, my whole feed was full of art. It still is. And I get all this amazing stuff. And so it just became this practice. This happened while I was really in the intense phase of writing my book. And I just started like every morning before I would start writing, I would go to my laptop and pick out a favorite piece of art and maybe pair it with a favorite piece of poetry or something and put it up on my socials. And I don't even know if I knew why I was doing it, but yeah, I was so immersed in this state of like the elevation of beauty and connection. And I found that when I did this, it attracted this amazing community of kindred spirits who also wanted to orient in that direction. I think that we have the choice at any moment of what direction we can turn in. And especially now, you can always turn in a toxic direction. It's always available to you. But there are these other directions as well. So that's why I do it.
Yeah. Like in a hard moment, I just thought that was a really nice thing that you share, because in a difficult moment, connecting to a beautiful scene or connecting to something that you really find deeply beautiful is a way to connect to something more positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the ones you were asking for a favorite, I don't know if I have an absolute favorite, but one of the ones I love is the one I put right at the introduction, because I have some art that I put into the book, Bittersweet. And right at the start of the introduction, there's a portrait, a watercolor portrait of a young woman. It's done by Tetiana Baranova. And she's from Ukraine. And
I see it. I'm just looking at it right now.
Yeah. And I just really love that portrait. And
she looks peaceful. Yeah,
she looks very peaceful and contemplative. And and I put that in before the war in Ukraine. And we've been in touch since.
Wow.
And Tetiana used to post a new watercolor every day on Twitter. And at the start of the war, she stopped posting for many months, but she's back again now. So that's good.
Nice. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you could share, if you have a writing tip or a couple of good writing tips that you felt helped you through this process.
Oh, gosh. Writing. Well, I'm sure there's... Okay. Maybe the most important one is from the time I first started writing in my early 30s, I would always write in an amazing Greenwich Village cafe. I would sit in the sunny cafe window and have my latte and my banana bread. And it was this act of intense daily pleasure. And I love having my latte, and I don't allow myself to have it anytime except when I'm writing. It's a kind of magic for me.
Yeah.
So over the years, I've really come to associate writing with like daily pleasure. So it's, I don't have that thing of like, oh, I don't want to go sit down at my desk. I have the opposite. It's like when we're on family vacation, I feel deprived if I can't go and have 2 hours with my laptop. So even on vacation, I do it. And I think it's been through, I didn't do this consciously, but I think it has been a kind of Pavlovian training process of learning to associate writing with happiness.
I love that. That's great. That's great.
Okay, can you share a book?
Oh, and can I just tell you one other, just because I think it matters so much.
Yes, please.
So the whole first, you know, I used to be a corporate lawyer, and then I started writing. And it was a few years before I started working on Quiet, which was the first thing I ever published. And I feel like it was really important to have those years when I was just doing it out of love and not trying to publish anything. Because that too, like, I guess it's again, the association process. It was like writing was just like a thing of love. It wasn't a thing of stress or competition or, you know, any of that stuff or deadlines. It was just the thing that I did. And I feel like I've been able to retain that sense, even now that it's become more of a career.
And as a corporate lawyer, I would imagine that, you know, the writing is kind of a way to like unwind from probably a hectic work environment.
Yeah. Well, at the beginning it was like that. But then once writing becomes a career, you know, then inevitably you have all those kinds of pressures, financial pressures and deadlines and, you know, all that other stuff that comes.
Yeah.
So it was just really good to have a few years where I was experimenting with writing memoirs and poetry and plays and all different things without having to think about any of that.
Right. There's something so beautiful about like having your hobby just as your hobby. And then when you choose to make it your career, there's something very special about that because you're living your passion. But then it comes with its hardships of practical things that you need to do and deadlines.
Exactly. So when I first started writing, I told myself that the goal was that I should publish something by the time I was 75. And at the time I was 33. I was giving myself 40 years because I didn't want to have that kind of pressure. I just wanted it to be the thing I was doing that I loved.
Wow. You did it a lot sooner than 75.
Yeah, I will say there's a woman. Are you familiar with Dr. Edith Eger, who wrote a book called The Choice?
Oh my gosh. People keep telling me about this book. I have to read it.
Yeah,
oh,
we interviewed her. You must
it's
read
my,
the book.
It's my favorite book of probably of all time, I would say.
I really feel memoir. That you would love it. We interviewed her, but the last line in her book, you know, she wrote this book in her 90s. And the last
So that's why I thought of her because she wrote it at 92 years old.
Wow. Are you serious?
Yeah. And it was her first book and it was a smash hit. She was on Oprah and it was so special. But
you should know the last line in her book, she says she feels younger than ever. and she's 90. So, and she's she's been through the horrors of the Holocaust. Like, you'll read it in her book, but she's just an extremely inspirational woman.
I have to get this book as soon as we hang up. I'm going to go order it. But I'm also going to tell you that during the time that I was a corporate lawyer, my grandfather, Rabbi grandfather, who we were talking about at the beginning, he died at the age of 94, and he continued working as a rabbi and giving sermons and all the rest until like 2 weeks before his death. And I remember really having a moment of being like, wow, would I be wanting to be practicing corporate law when I'm in my 90s? I was like, no, I don't even want to be doing it now here in my 20s. And that really got me off into a different path. And
wow.
And now I think about my grandfather all the time. I'm like, okay,
can I tell you, this is amazing.
This when I'm in my 90s.
Yeah, this is amazing. You are bringing up your grandfather right now, because I just got an email from Joseph Telushkin, because I couldn't remember his exact words. And he just wrote to me, yes, he was the rabbi. We're referring to your grandfather. He was the rabbi at Bethel Synagogue in Borough Park. And my uncle Bernard Resnick was a longtime president there. I did not know Rabbi Sher well. I met him several times at my uncle's house. My aunt and uncle serenaded him. And of course, from services I attend, one thing I do know from my various encounters with him, Rabbi Sher was a man of highest character and kindness. Mm-hmm. Joseph.
Yeah, he was very kind.
I just got this email this second.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
But that's very special that you ended up choosing your career path through watching your grandfather.
Oh my gosh. His whole house, he lived in this apartment in Borough Park that was like wall to wall books, every table covered with books. And I used to go there and he really wanted to write. He just never had time for it. He's the one who inspired me to become a writer for sure.
Wow. That's so beautiful. Do you have a favorite book or a book that you like to gift to others, or one that you've maybe read more than once that you can share?
Oh gosh. I will say I love so much the writer Alain de Botton. And there isn't even any one particular one of his books, but I would go to, if you Google the Book of Life and his name, Alain de Botton, A-L-A-I-N, and then D-E, and then B-O-T-T-O-N. He's kind of like an everyday philosopher and a beautiful writer, so much wisdom. So I really love him. Okay. And in terms of books, there's this book called Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, a psychologist. Yeah. And he talks about the state of flow where you're like completely engaged in what you're doing. You're neither bored nor anxious. You're just in exactly the right zone. And I found that book very transformative because it described my favorite state of being. And once I had a name for it, I like became completely dedicated to just organizing my life so that I would be in maximum flow all the time. So I really recommend that book too.
Awesome.
Okay. We'll get them. Haven't we heard of that book, Flow?
Yeah. I just can hear it.
Yeah. Well, now you're inspiring us to go get it. What message would you share with your younger self if you had the opportunity?
Well, I don't know, but I will tell you, my husband is, because I wanted to be a writer since I was 4, and it took me, you know, quite a while to get there. I think I published Quiet, I don't know, I was probably like 40 or something when it came out. So my husband is always saying to me, tell your 12-year-old self that this happened. Like when Bittersweet just came out and hit the bestseller list. Tell your 14-year-old self. And I love that. So
that's
I'm always
so
trying
sweet.
To do that. Yeah.
That's such a beautiful. Good take, because we often ask this question, and that's such a nice thing that your husband said. You tell your 12-year-old self, love it, love it. Okay. That's a good affirmation that we can do on ourselves. Like, we can tell our younger self where we are now.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially like when the dreams come true, like, you know, tell your younger self that this would have happened.
I love that. It's
great.
It's beautiful. Okay. So, and our final question is, do you have a favorite quote that resonates with you that you can share?
Oh my God. I have so many favorite quotes. So I'm now looking.
Feel free to share more than one.
Because I have so many things. I'll just give you one. I have a poem that is literally like taped to the lamp right next to where I'm sitting. So I'm going to read it to you. It's from Rumi, and it comes from the poem Love Dogs. This longing you expressed is the return message.
The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Wow. And I really love that. And that's what we were talking about all this time, like the, all these different traditions, they all talk about how like the spiritual longing actually is the answer itself.
Yeah. And for, you know, so many people have pain that holds them back from, you know, tapping into their full potential and being who they truly desire to be. I think this can be very helpful to know that, you know, your sadness is part of your process, and it can be that very thing that helps you grow and soar. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you for reminding us of that throughout your book, that our hardships, our sorrow, our pain is a way to lead to sweetness, and that they can, that the paradox can coincide. We really appreciate having this time with you, and we hope to be able to meet you in person sometime soon.
I hope so. It was so great to be able to connect with both of you. Thank you so much for doing this.